KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201 DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The Trump administration is building its case for undoing national monument protections, especially for two Biden-era designations supported by tribes. The U.S. Department of Justice just issued an opinion that presidents have the power to reverse protections provided in the Antiquities Act. It's the same law that allowed the creation of the Grand Canyon. In more than a century, using it to reduce protections has been exceedingly rare. We'll hear about the lands under scrutiny right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. Writer, actress, comedian, and activist Janice Schmieding is known for her work with Native-themed series such as Rutherford Falls and Reservation Dogs. But she's also a duck. The University of Oregon alum is this year's commencement speaker and spent this weekend reconnecting with her campus community. Schmieding graduated in 2005 with a degree in theater arts. On Saturday, she and her family tied on aprons and cooked fry bread tacos at the UO Longhouse for Native students, alum, and special dignitaries, including President Carl Schultz. Schmieding says it turns out Schultz's daughter is a fan of her work, and there's a new project underway.
We just shot a pilot, also created by Sierra Teller Ornelas, Bobby Wilson, and Jackie Kali'ia'a, three comedy writers. Sierra was the co-creator of Rutherford Falls, and it's a community center comedy that takes place in Oakland, but we shot it in Portland, and if the show gets picked up by NBC for a series run, we will shoot it in Portland.
For all of her comedy styling, Schmieding says she takes her role as this year's commencement speaker for the class of 25 very seriously. She gave a preview summary of her speech.
Special shout out to the Native grads, and I'm talking about Indigenous joy. I'm talking about joy in general and just the importance of maintaining joy as resistance, joy as an important part of sustaining our movements, and joy as a creative practice.
Schmieding says the collective struggle she and others faced as people of color really motivated her through her university experience, so coming back after 20 years brings those efforts full circle. The City of Hoonah and Hoonah Heritage Foundation unveiled a brand new 21-foot totem pole during a ceremony at the Hoonah Harbor at the end of May. The totem pole, called a kutia in Lingit, was designed and raised to honor the community's rich fishing history and traditions. KTOO's Clarice Larson was there and has the story.
It's called the Fisherman's Honor Totem Pole. Carved into the yellow cedar log are depictions of different fishing methods that locals use.
You have the gill netter, and then you have the rod and reeler.
Artist Gordon Greenwald describes the design of the brand new totem pole that now stands at Hoonah's Harbor. He speaks through a microphone to a crowd of more than 100 people who gathered for the ceremony.
So this is what you're looking at. The Hoonah fishing people, all of us in the past, all of us in the future, and all of us now.
Many Hoonah residents attended the event, and a catamaran brought dozens of people from Juneau for the ceremony. Fishing is deeply intertwined with the economy and identity of Hoonah. During the 1950s and 60s, Hoonah became known as the home of the million-dollar fleet. That's because of the local fishermen's highly lucrative skills and success on the water. Hoonah's Vice Mayor Amelia Wilson thanked the crowd for celebrating the kutia and the meaning behind it.
And to see so many of our fishermen and fisherwomen here really just makes me so proud to be honoring all of you and that legacy that we have of thousands and thousands of years of amazing fishermen.
David Shakely, a speaker at the event, says the pole honors the fishermen who are alive today and recognizes those who have passed away. He references the rain, which patters down on the tents above the crowd. Many people present were active or retired fishermen.
This kutia is here to help turn those tears of sorrow into tears of joy, to continue on the fishing that is so important within the community, to continue that on into the future.
The ceremony included traditional songs and dance as the tarp was pulled away from the pole to unveil it to the community. In Hoonah, I'm Clarice Larson.
And I'm Brian Bull with National Native News.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto needs at amerind.com.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Tribes and conservation groups are anticipating the Trump administration to reverse national monument designations very soon. The U.S. Department of Justice says presidents can do that under the nearly 120-year-old act that presidents have been establishing monuments all this time. The push by the Trump administration prompts concerns from tribes with deep cultural ties to land and Bears Ears in Utah and the recently designated Chuckwalla National Monument in California. Additionally, congressional Republicans propose selling off millions of acres of federal land, putting them permanently out of reach of public use. We'll speak with tribal leaders and legal experts about what's at stake for monuments and federal lands. We also want to hear from you too, our listeners. Does your tribe have ties to a recently designated monument? You can join this discussion with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Thermal, California, is Chairman Joseph Mireles. He is the chairman of the Torres Martinez Desert Kaweah Indians Community. Good morning, Chairman Mireles, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on.
Joining us from Blanding, Utah, is Davina Smith. She is the co-chair of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. She is Diné. Good morning to you as well, Davina, and thank you for joining the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And joining us from Boulder, Colorado, is Matthew Campbell. He is the deputy director of the Native American Rights Fund. He is a citizen of the Native Village of Gamble. Matthew, good morning, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Good morning, Sean, and thank you for having me.
Well, Matthew, I want to begin with you. We're talking about whether the president can reverse national monument designations. The Justice Department just issued an opinion saying the president can do that. Why is this a question after all this time, more than a century, of presidents using the Antiquities Act?
Sure, Sean. Well, I think it's part of a broader attack on public lands and seeking to remove protections from public lands to open those up for private gain. The decision that came out just recently from the Department of Justice suggesting that the president has authority to revoke a national monument designation really flies in the face of over 100 years of understanding that the president does not have that authority. And we actually think that the Antiquities Act is clear, that the language is clear, that the president indeed does not have that authority. But I think this is part of a broader conservative movement to open up public lands for mining and other private gain.
Now, during President Trump's first term, he significantly reduced the size of Bears Ears and Grand Escalante monuments. Why wasn't this decided by the courts then?
Sure. Well, you know, when President Trump took that unprecedented action back in 2017, of course, many of the tribal nations organized and filed a lawsuit against that revocation of Bears Ears, and others sued for the revocation of Grand Staircase. The issue moved through the courts, but as you may well be aware, courts are sometimes slow to act. And so we never did get an actual decision from the courts on that question. Our lawsuit, of course, NARF, we represent the Hopi tribe, the Ute Mountain Ute, and the Pueblo of Zuni in that litigation, alongside the Navajo Nation and the Ute Indian tribe. And in our lawsuit, that matter has been on hold since President Biden, of course, restored the protections at Bears Ears. And so we've been on hold, just waiting to see what will happen with the new administration.
Matthew, what are some of the potential repercussions here if different administrations go back and forth on either designating or revoking national monuments?
Well, I do think it does create a ping pong effect where you have protections in place and then they get removed and then they get added again. And so I think there will likely need to be some resolution at some point on this question. But, you know, the tribal nations have been steadfast in their desire to protect Bears Ears, to protect Baj Nwabjo, and all the other national monuments that they have advocated for. These places are immensely important, have sacred places, places of ceremony. And so they are steadfast in their efforts to protect these places and will continue to do so.
Now, the Antiquities Act allows for protections for small areas where important tribal items or sites require it. President Biden designated millions of acres, including more than 800,000 acres for Chuckwalla and another monument in California. Critics of this are saying that that exceeds the original intent of the law, these large swaths of land. What's your thought on that?
Well, yeah, I think first of all, there's a misconception that there is any size limits to national monuments. You know, when you look at the legislative history, when Congress was discussing the Antiquities Act for over 6 years, there was a lot of discussion about putting size limits on the president's authority. But at the end of the day, they came to a compromise and decided that, you know, in the president's discretion, he could protect all of the lands that are necessary to protect both historic and scientific objects. So there was a lot of debate about this question when the Antiquities Act was going through the legislative process. And at the end of the day, Congress made a compromise that allowed the president broad discretion to create monuments to protect historic and scientific objects, and also didn't place any cap on the size of those monuments. And I think when you look at one of the very first national monuments that was created in 1908, the Grand Canyon, it was over 800,000 acres. So looking at this history and the practices around the Antiquities Act, it's pretty clear that the president has broad authority to create large-scale monuments to protect historic and scientific objects, but that the language is clear that the president only has authority to create them, not destroy them.
Okay. If the president can take away protections for Chuckwalla, the national monuments we're talking about today, is it possible that he could also take away protections for places like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite or even the Gettysburg battle site?
Well, we disagree that the president can take away protections for Chuckwalla or Bears Ears or Baj Nwabjo or any national monuments because the language is clear. But there are also national parks like the Grand Canyon is now is different than a national monument. And national parks are, of course, created by Congress. And so that would take also an act of Congress to undo. But I think similarly with national monuments, because Congress delegated the president only the limited authority to create them, it would also take an act of Congress to undo a national monument as well.
Now, if the president reverses national monument status, it will likely go to the Supreme Court. Matthew, what legal arguments are we likely to hear there?
Well, I think the arguments that you'll see is that the Antiquities Act, the plain language of it is clear that it authorizes, it gives the president limited authority to proclaim or create national monuments and to reserve lands for those purposes. And it doesn't authorize the president to do the exact opposite, right, to unproclaim them or unreserve those lands. So I think that will be probably the key argument. But I think when you also look at the legislative history, it paints a clear picture as well that Congress knew what authority it was giving the president. And when you look at the practices that the president has utilized and also Congress weighing in over the years, you know, all the branches of government understood what the authorities were, and it was the authority only to create national monuments and not revoke them.
Now, Republicans in Congress also proposed selling millions of acres of public land as part of the president's spending bill. Is there a legal question about doing that?
Well, Congress does have authority under the Constitution to manage federal public lands. And so, you know, I think there is a large pushback against Congress taking steps to sell off public lands. But, you know, I think as we know, these lands are native lands. These are lands that have been stolen in many cases and taken away from tribal nations. And so tribal nations should also be on the list of entities that should have any lands restored to them.
And Matthew, going forward, any lessons from the first Trump administration or what we've seen these past few months in terms of what will happen to monuments or public lands in the future?
Well, I think that, you know, this new decision or opinion coming down from the Department of Justice is just another step clearing the path for the president to once again try and remove protections for national monuments. So I think that's certainly something that's on the list of the administration's tasks. But then you look at the broader actions the administration is taking. It's not just national monuments that are under attack, but all public lands. And so I think you'll see the opening up of public lands for private gain. And oftentimes it's going to be at the expense of tribal nations and their sacred places. You know, we've seen the Supreme Court remove protections under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act recently with Apache Stronghold. We've seen attacks on NEPA, environmental laws that protect many places as well, and processes in place that protect them. So I think it's just a broader attacks we'll continue to see on all of these federal lands.
Matthew Campbell, kicking off our conversation today here on Native America Calling. He is in Boulder, Colorado, where he's the deputy director of the Native American Rights Fund. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and continue our conversation with our other guests. We're talking today about monuments and the presidential administration and efforts to do away with some of these monuments. And we have the phone lines open for folks who have questions or have insights to share regarding our conversation. You can do that by calling 1-800-99-NATIVE. Just pick up your phone and call 1-800-99-NATIVE. Of course, that's also 1-800-996-2848. We're looking forward to listeners joining the conversation, sharing their insights, sharing their expertise, and that could be you. So give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. As part of the Trump administration's efforts to overhaul the federal government, transactions with services like Social Security and tax refunds are going completely paperless. We'll talk about who will be most affected and what people can do ahead of time to prepare. That's coming up on the next Native America Calling.
Support by AARP. Despite their service to our country, U.S. military vets, active duty service members, and their families are targeted by con artists significantly more than civilians and are 40% more likely to lose money than civilians. Vigilance is our number one weapon against fraud. You have the power to protect yourself. If an offer sounds too good to be true, it probably is. More at aarp.org/vetsfraudnetwork.
Yo and a hey, young guy, yo and a hey, 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 yo
Thanks for listening in to today's show on Native America Calling. We are discussing national monuments. The president has the power to set aside vast swaths of land. President Trump is signaling he may use that power to remove protections for national monuments, an action that is rarely done. You can join today's discussion by calling 1-800-996-2848. That number is 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got the phone lines open. We're waiting for your call. Let's hear now from Chairman Joseph Mireles with the Torres Martinez Desert Cahuilla Indians Community. He joins us now from Thermal, California. And Chairman, we heard Matthew Campbell describe some of the legal significance with regard to what's at stake here. But please remind us of what Chuckwalla National Monument land means to you and other tribes in California.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. So the Chuckwalla National Monument isn't just a piece of land, and I think that's what gets lost in translation when we start having conversations with politicians or with the president for that matter, is the fact that Chuckwalla National Monument is a sacred area to the tribes in this region, because that is where a lot of creation stories from some of our tribes come from, is the Chuckwalla National Monument area, the hills there. We also have trails of where we used to migrate from place to place, destination to destination. There are villages there. There are lots of historical and ancestral artifacts there. It's just a place of healing for a lot of tribes here. And when we went to start the conversation about forming this monument, we knew that there was going to be some economic pushback in regards to, green energy and stuff like that. So we included some of that language in the monument language. So we're not just saying that, oh no, we want this off limits. We want to educate people about how important this area is, and we want to be stewards of this land like we always have been.
Now, without national monument status, what concerns you most, Chairman, with regard to that land and some of these cultural significances that you mentioned?
I think one of the main concerns that a lot of us have is that it is going to be looked at as a private area where we're going to have private investors come in and they're going to damage a lot of the historical markers that we have there. They're going to damage a lot of the trails, in hopes of just trying to benefit for profit. And we just need to do what we can as tribes in this area to continue the fight to make sure that we hold this land sacred. And like I said, that we are continue to be the stewards of this property.
How long has your tribe been working to get monument status?
We've been working on it for a while. It's been at least 10 years that we started the conversations.
Okay. And currently, do you have a voice with members of the president's administration right now?
Not currently, to be honest. I'm newly elected as the chairman. Our former chairman was doing a lot of, was talking to the previous administration before. But, now that I'm on, we haven't had as much communication with this administration.
What about the state of California? Are you getting any support or dialogue with state government?
I haven't had the conversations yet because I'm not ready to pull that trigger, if you say, because we need to make sure that we're fighting as a tribe. And once I need to get additional support, then we'll reach out to who we need to reach out to try to, continue to make this a national monument and to keep it a national monument.
And in the event that monument status is ultimately undone, how do you expect your tribe and perhaps other tribes to respond?
Fight. We're going to have to, unfortunately, we're going to have to figure out what we need to do. We've been fighting for years to get it to this point, so we're not just going to let it, let it die down.
Okay. And community members, what are you hearing from them? What are they saying?
Community members, they want it, it's a give and take. The community members that are local to us here, they know the importance of the monument. They've been to it. They've, hiked those grounds, so they can see that. And that's the other thing is looking on the map, it just looks like rock formations and dirt. But you have to actually have boots on the ground here to see the beauty of the area and just to know that this, you can feel that this is a sacred place when you step foot on it. So a lot of the community members that have been hiking there or have been through there or have gone through tours through there, they know the significance of it and they feel it and they want to keep it that way without having to worry about, anything being torn down or anything be drilled into.
And Chairman, how about you? How often are you able to go out there and visit these lands and practice some of these just and practice some of these traditions.
Way out there when it's not too hot.
Yeah. I imagine it's pretty hot there now.
Yeah, we're in the desert. It's 120 in July and August, so those times we're not so much out there. But throughout the year, we have our youth go out there. We take the community out there. So we go out there frequently to the area because it's literally 20 minutes from me.
And are there any other uses for the land that the tribe has other than what you've talked about so far?
No, right now that's mainly just what we want to do. We want to hold our land sacred and just work with the other tribes to figure out what's going to be the best method to inform the community of these lands and how to make them, you know, how people can view them. I want to be able to see what's here. I want them to see the beauty of what's here and, you know, just live in these lands like they do with the other national parks, like the Grand Canyon. Like, this should be a destination where people come, they look, they participate, and they just understand what this means to us. Because, again, it's not just about the tribes in this area. It's about the Eastern Coachella Valley as a whole. And at the end of the day, if it starts getting tapped away and it starts losing its benefits to the tribe and the community, then it just becomes another land base. And I don't want it to, we don't want that to happen.
And what about some of these other communities there in the Coachella Valley that you mentioned, perhaps non-native communities? Are you hearing from them? And if so, what are their concerns? Are they supportive of the tribe?
I've heard support. Yeah, I've heard support from some of the nonprofits in the area, some of the other like land-based and you know, land-based organizations. They're really supportive of keeping this as a national monument and letting the tribe be the ones to be the stewards of this land.
What if some sort of a compromise was reached and ultimately the monument was reduced, smaller acreage? Is that something that the tribe would be willing to negotiate over?
It's a conversation that we haven't entertained yet because we'd like it to stay as is. But, you know, we try to be as amenable as possible, but we'd like to keep it as is.
And for our listeners who might not be fully in understanding of what this means when an area is designated with monument status, what exactly does that status do to protect the land and allow the tribe to use the land in the way that you folks are using it now?
So what we're looking to do is we're looking to form a coalition between the other tribes in the area, because like I said, it's not just Torres Martinez that has significance when it comes to dealing with this land. It's also the sister tribes that are in the area. So we're forming a coalition so we can, and I keep using the word stewards, but it's the only way to describe it, is, you know, make sure that we're the stewards of the property and just to ensure that, you know, nothing's happening there that's destroying what we hold sacred. So we're trying to form a coalition with the other tribes so that we can work together on how we establish that. This would be our first co-management agreement on a monument. This is the first time we've ever had a monument. So we're going to have a little bit of a learning curve and, you know, we're going to have a little growing pains, but ultimately, we just want this area to be protected so that our sacred sites aren't destroyed.
Chairman Reales, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate you spending time.
Thank you for having me.
Phone number is 1-800-99-NATIVE for listeners who would like to join the conversation. Maybe you yourself are in the area of the Coachella Valley that we're talking about today, and you have insights with regard to the Chuckwilla National Monument. You'd like to share the conversation. You can do so by giving us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can join the conversation. And let's bring Davina Smith into the conversation now. She's in Blanding, Utah, co-chair of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. And Davina, let's talk more about the Bears Ears Monument designation. It's gone back and forth since President Obama first established it. What are your primary concerns right now?
First of all, it's just a headache of the back and forth. It's becoming really ridiculous. But overall, I have to say that I also want to intertwine it with the statement or the opinion from the DOJ. You know, being a coalition member and also representing my Navajo people, as a Diné woman, I know that this land is not just land. It's our mother, our teacher, our connection to the ancestors. You know, the Department of Justice quiet release of an opinion attempting to justify the revocation of the National Monument Protection is not just a legal maneuver. It is also a direct threat to the spiritual, cultural, and ecological integrity of places our people have protected for generations. So this attempt to rewrite the meaning of the Antiquities Act is dangerous and deeply disrespectful. For over a century, this law has safeguarded sacred places like Bears Ears, Grand Staircase, Baj, and so many other places, you know, where for us as Native, where our prayers, our songs, and story live. It was never meant to be a tool to take protections away, only to honor and to preserve the places that hold meaning for all people. So since, you know, the president's returning to office, it has impacted public lands in a negative way, and our tribal for our tribal nations, from stripping funding and even firing frontline workers that work in our national parks, monuments, and also to opening the door and exploitation. So this administration's attacks are layered with historical erasure. And now with Interior Secretary Burgum's plan to dismantle protections across more than, I believe, 13 million acres, we are witnessing another chapter in a long legacy of broken promises to Indigenous people. The lands, you know, they are targeting are not empty. They are alive with memory. They hold our ancestors' footsteps, healing plants, and ceremonial grounds. So these aren't just objects of interest, as the law describes. They are part of who we are. And so as a Diné person, you know, I was taught to live in Hojon, balance, beauty, and respect. So the DOJ's opinion violates that sacred balance. So for me, being a part of the coalition and commission, one thing is, you know, I, for one, will not remain silent while our sacred places are being put at risk for a short-term political gain. And so the Antiquities Act must be upheld, not reinterpreted to fit an agenda of extraction.
Okay, Davina, you mentioned mining. Let's talk more about that, because the president has said he wants to ramp up domestic oil and mineral production. What is the pressure there at Bears Ears specifically?
So mining, gosh, I can definitely honestly relate to that because I grew up, my grandfather worked in the uranium mines, and San Juan County is, it is known for its high mineral content of uranium and vanadium. So the thought of these places being reopened and being drilled, and it kind of draws that triggering perspective from what my grandfather went through. And my grandfather and grandmother had passed away from uranium. And also in Monument Valley area, there's high contents. There's one area that I've shared so many times that how I've been impacted of our land. We used to herd sheep with my grandmother, and we always used to go to a certain spring where we would have our sheep drink from there. We also would bathe in there with my sister.
Myself, Pharaoh, Matt Brown. Warren Wilson. Get approval of
the agenda. I'll
second. Roll call. Amy?
Yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Are there any public comments on agenda items? New business resolution 2503. So this resolution, the USD has a new process, and so we had to name Mr. Franklin the signatory, and then also they needed additional people. So Austin as a technology director and Lisa as a business manager have access to, they don't sign, I'm assuming, they just have access to the Lisa information. Okay. And they, USDA wanted it completed within a resolution form. So is there a motion to accept resolution 2503?
I'll make that motion to accept resolution 2503.
I'll second.
Roll call.
Rita?
Yes, but I never did get the resolution.
It was in the board packet.
We didn't get it. I didn't get a board packet.
I emailed it with the agenda in the same email.
Okay, thank you. But yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Rayette?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Motion carries.
And it looks like, Rita, you'll have to sign as the secretary.
Oh, I think it's
right.
I think that's
your signature.
Yeah. Well, that's the USDA, and then providing the 4 minutes as well.
I think it's because it's through the office, so the office personnel. Since Cheryl is the secretary, she'll sign.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the board just has to approve the resolution.
Yeah, gotcha. Just the secretary on the bottom with the signature line. Yeah. So. Agenda's executive support. Is there a motion to go into executive sessions?
Oh, second.
Roll call.
Rita?
Yes.
Amy?
Yes.
Hillary?
Yes.
Carla?
Yes.
Rayette?
Yes.
Rita?
Yes.
Brenda?
Yes.
Motion carries. Rita, and then there's a computer laptop set up in my office.
Okay.
Cheryl, I did find the resolution. Thank you. I apologize for that.
Cool, we got some blank air space. I guess that was an extremely quick meeting. It doesn't appear to be going on anymore. And let's get back to what was up, huh? We still have quite a bit of time here.
The pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Global leaders, policymakers, innovators, and indigenous voices will join at Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Dena'ina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. This summit includes critical discussions on geopolitics and security that shape the future of the far north, builds international partnerships, and provides northern cultural experience. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com, who support this show.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska, for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska, operating in Alaska for more than 50 years and valuing the opportunity to partner with Alaska Native communities.
We're glad you're joining us today on Native America Calling. We're talking about the potential removal of national monument status for lands that tribes deem important. And we're learning about an untested legal authority that grants the president the power to do that. You can join this discussion by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. I want to bring another guest into our conversation now who joins us from Klamath, California. We have Tiana Williams-Clausen. She is the Yurok Tribe's wildlife director, and she's also a Yurok tribal citizen. Tiana, good morning, and welcome back to Native America Calling. It's great to have you back on the show.
Good morning. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to pivot a little bit and talk about the Yurok Tribe, along with some conservation groups, who just completed a 23-year effort to return over 47,000 acres of land. Tell us more. What is this land, and what's the significance to your people?
Sure. So this is, as you say, over 47,000 acres of land within Yurok ancestral territory. The Yurok people have been very blessed in the sense that we never did get removed fully off of our lands, but we did get pushed onto a relatively narrow strip of our lands, the Yurok Reservation, which only encompassed about 10% of that ancestral territory. The rest of it has been in management by U.S. Forest Service, National Park Service, and a hodgepodge of different private landowners. And so this was land that was owned by our neighbor, Green Diamond Timber Company, and we were glad to work with them and with Western Rivers Conservancy to purchase those acres back.
Now, this is a final swath of land. Other acres have already been returned, so this now completes the total amount of land that is returned. What are your plans now with this property?
So we've been working with Western Rivers Conservancy, who's kind of been, they did kind of the purchasing process and then passed it through to us through this partnership. So we've been co-managing these lands actively since the whole of it kind of passed into Western Rivers ownership. So in particular, the full of the 47,000 acres is kind of split into two halves. The one half is called our community forest, which is designed for human use, I guess you might prioritize it. So having people out there on the landscape, economic investments, things like that, such as, you know, cottage industries or sustainable timber harvest and the like. The other half of it, and the thing that I'm most excited about, I have to admit, is the Blue Creek Sanctuary. And so the Blue Creek Sanctuary, the salmon sanctuary, is designed purely for ecosystem restoration. And so that's what we're going to be working on probably for the next three or four generations there. But it's exciting to have the capacity to do it.
So the Conservancy took possession of the land, kind of an intermediary between you and this timber company. Tell us a little bit more about that history there with the timber company and how the switch was made through Western River Conservancy. Was that a good business deal? I mean, did everybody get along and did it proceed smoothly?
Well, it was complicated for sure. And don't ask me about the particulars of this because it's above my pay grade, as I say, but it took something like five or six different sorts of mechanisms in order to raise the funds to make the actual purchase. And so Green Diamond Resource Company and ourselves, we joined in good faith to make this happen. Western Rivers was a really great partner, help us mediate that complexity. And Green Diamond still does own a lot of properties in and around the Yurok Reservation. So we're in ongoing relationship with them as we use the same roads to get to our various properties. We have different agreements to do restoration work on Green Diamond lands. They come onto our lands to do some of the wildlife surveys they need to do. So it's an ongoing relationship it's actually pretty neat.
Mm. Now, I want to clarify for our listeners, this is not trust land like we might be familiar with on reservations in other parts of the country, but can you give us more of an explanation as to the legal status of this land in relation to the Yurok Tribe?
Sure. So we do have our trust land status, and a small portion of these lands do fall within that because that's within the Yurok Land Reservation. So it's within the Yurok Tribal jurisdiction fully. But the majority of it is off the reservation, and so is what's called fee land. And so fee land is just owned property like anybody can own property. And so it is subject to what we call, what we determine to be co-management with the state. And the state's been, thankfully, pretty agreeable to that. We're doing, like I said, a lot of land restoration work out there, creek restoration work. And so we are in conversation with them regularly. Okay, well, what's the permitting process? How do we facilitate this? We've been working with the state to find funding to do some of these restoration projects. But in its simplest form, basically, it's land that the tribe owns in the same way that anybody could own lands in California.
Let's talk a little bit of history here. The land was originally taken during the California Gold Rush during the mid-1800s. What did the tribe traditionally use that land for? And have there been major changes with regard to, like, I understand there was some gathering of traditional foods and medicines and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. How has that changed the culture and the community over the years?
Well, I mean, it's a large swath of ancestral territory. It's not the full scope of it, but it's just not having that land and having access to it has been very difficult for the Yurok people because, of course, we're land-bound people. We're very tied to the land that we co-evolved with. Blue Creek itself has been and remains one of the most important tributaries to the Klamath River, which is a lot of where our reservation follows along and is kind of one of our key central areas. And so we really prioritize this land transfer because of the need to get this creek back into shape. And it's kind of funny because if you look at it from, you know, an outsider's perspective, it actually looks like one of the most beautiful and pristine areas in California. It's just absolutely gorgeous. But from kind of the local knowledge, we know that there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. But so Blue Creek itself has a whole host of diversity of plants and animals that are traditionally important to Yurok people. Everything from deer and elk to the Indian potato to ceanothus to our medicinal plants like vine tea. And the goal is to get a lot of the invasives out of there that unfortunately alternative management has helped bring in, and then replant those natives, get forests back into kind of a diverse, biodiverse health, get our creeks back into shape, which were unfortunately put into poor condition from timber harvest, not necessarily specifically Green Diamond. There's been various timber managers throughout the years, but all with this goal to just bring this diversity of wildlife and plants and fish species back into good health.
This sounds like something, it's going to take a lot of expertise to make this all happen. Tell us a little bit more about the team you have working on some of these efforts.
Absolutely. So the Yurok tribe has long been what we call a natural resource tribe. Not that we don't expand into social services and language and all these other really incredible things that our tribal people need, but we got started with a strong emphasis on bringing the world back into balance. That's kind of what we consider our fundamental reason for being, as being world renewal people. And so our natural resource division is made up of several departments. So mine own is the wildlife department. We've got the fisheries department. We have an environmental department. We have a forestry department. We have a watershed department. And so we work in combination to use not only the traditional knowledge of what the lands are supposed to look like or what they need, because all of our leadership is Yurok, but also kind of that Western science. Like myself, I have a biochemical sciences degree from Harvard, you know, and we've got a whole host, we've got PhDs in there and things like that as well doing our work. But then also a lot of really great on-the-ground expertise. So, for example, our watershed restoration crew is very skilled in the heavy equipment work that's needed to do for large-scale landscape restoration. And they're investing in the next cohort of heavy equipment operators through this work so that we can continue the work through the generations. There's a lot of different types of knowledge that are going to come into this sort of work.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it, Tiana. Now, you're working also on a restoration program with plans to restore 300 total acres of prairie land. What's the state of that land?
Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited about that project. So historically, of course, these forests were a lot more biodiverse than they are now. We had our old growth redwood forests. We had, you know, insets, woodlands. We had our Port Orford cedar, all of these different species. over the years, with the focus on pure economic development, a lot of these species got removed, our old growth redwoods in particular. But something that a lot of people don't think about is, as part of a healthy forest here in what basically is the Pacific Northwest, was the value of the prairies themselves. And so the Yurok people traditionally, historically, would maintain them through the use of fire, prescribed fire, traditional fire. And then also, I'll throw in there, the grizzly bears who used to be here, the elk that used to be here in abundance, helped us maintain these prairies. A lot of these prairies were either planted over for timber harvest or were allowed to be encroached upon because they weren't, quote unquote, valuable under the new regime. And so Stevens Prairie is one of our healthiest prairies to date. Overall, though, our prairie system has been reduced to just 1% of what it was pre-contact. And prairies are just incredibly important for ecosystem health, for maintaining water in the dry seasons, for a biodiversity of plants, for the insects that rely on those plants, and then the birds that rely on those, and the ungulates that rely on the grasses and all that sort of stuff. We're finding in our new tools of science that they're incredibly important actually for carbon sequestration as well. In climate change, they're important for serving as kind of like fuel breaks, natural fuel breaks, so that these catastrophic fires slow down once they hit them. So they're incredibly important both kind of historically and all of the foods and resources that we relied on and which we care took, but also kind of in the face of modern day challenges as well. And so this Stevens Prairie is one of the healthiest extant prairies that we've had and is relatively newly encroached upon because it was actually a timber harvest area for Green Diamond. And so they were actually cutting it down regularly, which actually helped preserve that prairie. Since it kind of started transferring to Western Rivers and ourselves, there was a lot of Doug fir encroachment. We call Doug fir our native invasive because it will take over so quickly. And so we started out with 61 acres completed of just removing that Doug fir, removing as much of the invasives that we could, and then replanting with hundreds of pounds of native seed to help kind of bring it back to that prairie characteristic. It's really important to get started on this now because if a prairie remains a forest for too long, it'll actually change the entire chemistry of the forest soil or of the prairie soil so that once it becomes forest soil, it becomes much harder to become prairie soil again.
That's so fascinating.
That said, we finished 61 acres and then we have a goal to expand that to 300 acres within this newly managed land, newly owned land.
Tiana, we've talked a lot on our show over the last few months about federal cuts, proposed cuts, carried out cuts. What are some of the impacts you see with regard to restoration projects like what you folks are working on in some of these federal cuts?
Well, I think that we're going to have to be more flexible in how we look at these projects. So, for example, we're cutting down a lot of Doug fir. Some people are kind of scared of that idea, cutting down trees, but it's actually healthy for the system. But if we're looking for support for clearing a prairie, maybe we couch it in terms of, hey, we're looking to invest in timber harvest, which, you know, may not be the primary goal, but it is something that could come out of this and help support the tribe. So we're going to have to flex how we think about this. And unfortunately, we've definitely seen cuts to some of the projects that not only we were expecting, but a couple of them that we already thought we had in hand, you know, that have been cut. Thankfully, while the federal government kind of readjusts itself to the current administration's priorities, California is really stepping up. And so California actually passed what's called the Prop 4, and it is bringing in millions and millions of dollars towards landscape work. And so we are going to be we're working with California as well as other partners to raise the funds through kind of more local state and private foundations to continue to get the work done.
Again, this goes back 23 years, the effort to return the last of these acreage, now 47,000 acres. And have you folks been communicating with other tribes there in California and elsewhere about what you've learned? And are you able to provide expertise or guidance to those other tribal nations?
One of the really neat things about being here is there are so many tribes with so much great expertise. We absolutely are going to be sharing what we learned from this, because this is one of the largest prairie restorations that's going to be in this area. But there's a lot of prairie work that's being done here, as well as tying in with riparian restoration, because actually down in Blue Creek as well, our fisheries department is doing restoration for the creeks themselves to kind of for that watershed-based approach. But we're actually really pleased that we've got like the Yurok Cultural Site Management Council, who's bringing in their expertise. Our neighbors upriver, the Kudzu'k, have wonderful elk expertise. And we're always happy and wanting to share information between our natural resource divisions to kind of make the whole area better. So I'm excited about what we're both going to be able to share and be able to learn.
All right, Tiana, really appreciate you joining the conversation. We've got about a minute left. I want to pivot back to Matthew Campbell with the Native American Rights Fund. Matthew, I'm going to give you the last word, and I want you to share with our listeners any lessons you've learned on protecting lands with all your work representing various tribes throughout the years.
Thank you, Sean. Well, I think as we've heard from Chairman Morales and Davina and Tiana, you know, these lands are immensely important to our people and our cultures and who we are. You know, they're tied to our histories. There are many sacred places throughout all of these lands that are worthy of protection. And it's not just a playground where folks can come and recreate, right? These places are important for many, many different reasons. And so you see with the co-management that we've seen at Bears Ears, at Yurok, the importance of these places. And I would ask the Secretary of Interior to come out to consult with tribes before taking any action to impact these lands negatively.
All right. We're out of time, unfortunately, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation. But big thanks to the guests who joined us today, Matthew Campbell, Tiana Williams-Clausen, Davina Smith, and Chairman Joseph Mireles. We'll be back tomorrow to help people prepare for paperless transactions. The federal government is moving to electronic payment methods for transactions such as Social Security payments and tax refunds. We'll find out the steps people will need to take to get ready. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, big wave here. I'm going to head up to the store for a second. I got to get a money order, then put it in my bank account, you know, through my phone. It's kind of cool you can do that these days. We don't have a bank up here, of course, but hey, technology is wonderful, isn't it? And so if I miss a downbeat or two, don't be concerned. I will be back as soon as possible.
Guys, don't wait until you have a syndrome. You're going to check up, catch healthy issues early. And the condition, diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian healthcare provider what health checkups are recommended for you, your age and lifestyle. A message from Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service.
Indigenous leaders, global business executives, diplomats, and top government officials will attend Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's premier Arctic policy and business event. From July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, this international summit convenes voices from across the Arctic and beyond. High-level panels, networking, the Far North Fashion Show, and unique cultural programming. Arctic Encounter is where global decisions meet northern realities. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com, who support this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.